at 3:30 this afternoon. Okay. So today we're going to start over, basically. I'm going to take everything that we learned, and we're going to redo the calculation in a much more streamlined way and get back out the results that we had for the power spectrum. So basically, the philosophy of what we've done so far is that we've worked at the level of the Einstein equation. So basically, this equation. And we separated out each piece into the background and the fluctuation. And we worked really hard to figure out sort of how the best way of writing, for example, the metric fluctuations were, and if we had a general stress energy tensor, what the best way of writing the fluctuations in the stress energy tensor were. And the basic things that we found, or the key results so far, for the scalar sector, is that even though you thought you started with all these terms, B, E, psi, phi, and delta phi, by the time you used you fixed the gauge, so let's say gauge invariance, and by the time you used the equations, Einstein equations, you found that there's only one degree of freedom left, essentially. So remember in the conformal Newtonian gauge, we got rid of these two. We found that we had an equation relating psi in terms of phi, and actually it was very simple. Those two were just equal. And we also found a relationship then relating delta phi and psi. Okay, so basically we ended up with just one real free degree of freedom. And we also found that there was a tensor part that was much simpler, and that was this Hij. And we found that in both cases, up to some normalizations, these things had the equations of the scalar field in De Sitter, plus some small corrections from the fact that it's not exact De Sitter. Okay? So we found, basically, from all of this, we found P, let's call it PH, and P delta phi. Okay? All right. So that's great, but it's really hard in this language to go beyond that. So these are the power spectrums, sorry. And both of them sort of go like H squared with some factors. Okay? So we found that, so this is great in this language, and it allowed us to get to here, but it doesn't allow us to do much more, right? It's already tricky, it's already complicated. You know, there seem to be lots of variables, and you have to figure out what to do to get to here, and then we're pretty much done. So one thing I want to stress is that at the level of the two-point function, there's not necessarily anything deep to verify for you that the story that we told here, even though it's a very nice story, is the right story. At some level, all we needed was the right equation of state and the fact that H wasn't exactly constant, and we could believe that there were some set of fluctuations that had a particular amplitude and a particular spectral index that's slightly red. So what we can do is say, well, it's fine at that level to work with the gravity in this sense, but if we remember that we can imagine that this equation is generated from a variational principle of the action, that's going to be a much more powerful formalism to do this. So now, basically, get the Einstein equations by variation. And so we're going to go back and actually work with the action. So that we explicitly keep the Einstein hope. Yeah. What does what? Sorry, Einstein equations. Sorry. Yeah. Or electrical engineering, or many other exciting things. Easter or something, Easter equations. Okay, so we want the Einstein-Hilbert term, and then we want the usual stuff for our scalar field, right? So we've always been sort of imagining that the scalar field had its action, but we haven't been necessarily doing the complete thing. So remember, this is just something like dU phi, dU phi minus v. Okay. So for the most part today, except when it's actually really important for dimensions, I'm going to drop m planks, set that equal to 1, and there are a couple places where I'll have to go back and put them back in. But for the most part, what that means is that often when I write an action, there's going to be an m planck squared sitting out in front secretly. So if the dimensions don't look right, check if with an m planck squared in front they're right. Okay? Okay. So this is what we want to do. And remember that we already discussed how the real goal is to actually expand in fluctuations and write this as some background piece, some quadratic piece, and then the rest of the corrections, right? And just to reiterate, we know what the equations of motion here are, and we have 3h squared is the energy, which is basically just set by the potential. And what we got out of this was some background h of phi and h dot, where really, so h dot characterizes the deviation with time, and we can essentially replace this if we like by h prime of phi. Or let me use h comma phi just so we don't, just to be consistent. Okay, that was it. That was all we needed. Okay, and then we went to a lot of work to work out the fluctuations from S2. And now what we're going to do is we want to basically find explicitly what this is by expanding all of the fields. And we want to verify that we can use this guy directly to quantize the appropriate field in the scalar sector. Okay, so we're going to S2 for a scalar variable. And use it to quantize. And we can actually do the same thing for the tensor. Okay. So let me just say that again in words so that you have it, the power of the approach that we're making here. So what do we gain? So I'd say the basic thing that we gain is that we can go beyond the two-point or the power spectrum. In a very neat way, right? Because now we know that the only thing we need to do to get the next order term in terms of the statistics of the field, which we said is the relevant information, is to calculate this guy and get then a related, you know, something that's related to the power spectrum instead of the expectation value of 2 of the fields, expectation value of 3 of the fields. So that's extraordinary because it really lets us get more detailed and more meaningful information. At this level, everything's sort of just a free field, could be anything. It doesn't have very deep information, but this does. The second reason it does is related. Basically, once we have this whole formalism, where essentially we can bring in all of our knowledge of field theory and apply it to this case. Okay, so really, we can let's see, how should I say it? We can use full Q of T and apply to inflation. Which means basically we can worry about things like how do we make an effective field theory? Let me write it out, sorry. So I don't know which types of topics you've learned about so far in field theory, but one of the important things is how we parameterize our ignorance, or how we try to make the most general theory of a particular physical phenomena, right, in a consistent way by, for example, looking at all of the symmetries and including all of the terms in the action that are consistent with symmetries and parameterizing any scales of other physics that come in, things like that. So we can try to use those ideas, which is going to allow us to do a lot better than just say, suppose I have m squared phi squared, suppose I have lambda phi 4. Okay, for a long time, cosmologists were guilty of sort of just making up. I mean, it's not totally true, but to some extent it looks like a lot of people were just making up potentials, even though there was usually some good justification. But you can start to be a lot more precise about what constitutes a justified potential. Okay, and it also means that if you have a particular theory in mind, string theory, supersymmetry, whatever, you can choose, and you know the action for that field, then you can use this whole framework to use that field as the inflaton and check again if it really works consistently. So we have a more direct connection, let me say, direct connection to fundamental, to possible, let me say possible, fundamental descriptions. And by fundamental here, I just mean that we don't just postulate a scalar field, but we take one that we think we have some other, so we think exists for some other good reason, and we try to do inflation with that. And the other thing that it allows us to do in this direction are to do things like, for example, loop calculations. So part of the whole interesting part of the field theory is when you start to take things beyond the free field, right? So you look at interactions and how you control interactions at high energies. And part of that is checking what happens when you do loops. So you can do that. And this whole thing is now going to check the consistency of this framework in a much more detailed way. Yeah, so that's a good question, right? So to some extent, you would have thought back in the beginning that the relevant scale was M Planck, right? And you have some consistency conditions, like H over M Planck less than 1, so that your energy stays below, essentially, the Planck energy. So V to the 4 should be less than M Planck to the 4 if you're in a regime where you can control it. But other things can pop up, right? If you think you're in string theory, then you want to control string corrections, and you have the string scale in there. Or, there are lots of other scales that can come in once you start thinking about it in this way. And that's actually important, yeah? And finally, the other thing that this does is it basically, because we've now written R here, and we're going to expand about a background in terms of a small fluctuation, basically it leads us in the direction of the graviton, right? So it leads us towards the graviton. In other words, there's going to be tons more physics in this formulation than there was in the old one. Okay. So the particular formalism that works here is one that I think that's very efficient here is one that you've seen already probably in other classes, GR maybe something, and that's ADM formalism. And basically, this is sort of related to making a Hamiltonian formulation of GR. In the sense that we're going to suppose that what the action does is it takes a set of spatial metrics and evolves them with time. So we're basically splitting up things into the time evolution of the spatial part. Okay. So sometimes, I don't know, people call it this. So time evolution. The metric. And you can see that this is particularly nice for inflation because in some sense that's the system that we have, right? We have this slowly rolling or this classical scalar field that's driving for us a small shift, but nonetheless a shift in the background metric, H of phi, right? And that's setting sort of a clock for us, right? So it seems very natural for inflation. And I think in some ways that's why it's so simple. And what it does is it basically, in practice, what's going to happen is instead of going directly to the Einstein equations, right, we introduce these things that are like Lagrange multipliers that are going to give us constraint equations. And those are going to more simply, when we solve for those, do the same work that this business of solving for the Einstein equation, solving Einstein equations was. So now constraints and fields, non-dynamical fields that we put into the action. Do the work. So it's a lot more streamlined. Okay. So let me also just say here maybe that a lot of this sort of very streamlined formulation is actually quite recent. And so I'm going to give you two archive numbers for papers so that if this actually matters to you at some point in detail, you can go and you can look at in more detail at those papers. And one that was extremely influential was by Juan Maldacena, who's visiting right now, actually. And this is from 2002. And then one of the calculations that I'm going to show you that I think is interesting was done in detail in this paper. And basically, because of what I've said here, both of these papers are actually, their purpose is to talk about non-Gaussianity. And that essentially means these higher order terms. So until we really had to think carefully about stuff like this, it didn't matter quite so much, even though it wasn't so clean, it didn't matter quite so much what the derivation was. But when you really want to talk about these guys, it's much, much, much nicer to go to this formalism. So that's part of the reason this is so recent. Okay. So the basic starting point from this guy you're probably familiar with, and that is that we write the metric in terms of these two quantities, the lapse and the shift. This one we saw before with Andrew. And it's just a relationship between sort of proper time and a cosmological time. And this one we haven't used so far in this class, the shift. And then this guy is gonna contain the dynamics. So these two guys are going to be Lagrange multipliers, and this one's going to be dynamical. And then we also have delta phi for the inflaton, which is dynamical. So this means that there are going to be no time derivatives of these quantities that enter the action. They're going to be spatial derivatives, but no time derivatives. And then hij delta phi will have time derivatives. And we haven't solved the whole problem here, right, obviously. I mean, we still are going to have an issue of gauge choice. And we're essentially going to use the gauge that I introduced yesterday and maybe we mentioned before, which is the co-moving gauge, although you can make lots of choices, but that's just a simple choice because then we're going to get back that variable zeta, which is conserved. Okay. Okay, and we're basically going to, still consider the usual background metric to be the FRW1. Okay. So what we need to do, basically, is rewrite that action over there, right? So there we had root G and we had capital R. And now we want to rewrite it using this metric for G. So we're going to explicitly break up the time part and the spatial part. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to collect important results on this board. Hopefully I'll get it right and work on the other board. So let's start by putting the action here. Okay. So this is going to be our key results board. And you can see that what we have to do is basically, of course, I already erased one of the key results, which was the action here, but basically we have to figure out what root G is and what R was, right, in terms of this metric. And we're going to rewrite everything in terms of H, essentially. So the spatial part and the time part are going to separate. So, for example, before we had root minus G, if we just plug in what that is, we can see that we're going to have something like an N and root H appearing, okay? So that's an easy substitution to do. To really work this out, you need the inverse metric. So because I want to work out, I'll do just one of the steps. So a lot of the steps here are just algebraic steps. They're not particularly interesting. So I'm just going to show you a short one so you get a feel for how it works, and then you don't take my word for the rest of it. But it's useful if you have this guy. And basically, on each of these terms, you just have, I'm going to put parentheses here when I mean those ni's and nj's, okay, because there are also going to be normal n squares and stuff appearing, 2 and 3. And on the diagonal, you have things that are a little more interesting. Let me just write one of them, n squared. And now this h is that little hij, h11, n1. Squared. So I'm gonna at some point erase this whole big thing, and we won't need this. This won't be totally a key result, but let's leave it for now. N squared. Basically, you can guess this is going to be H12 because it's in the H12 column, and that's going to have N1, N2, et cetera. Okay, so basically in each spot here, these are still just the NIs, and on each term here, the H's are going to change their indices, and the N's are going to change for whatever the appropriate one is in each slot. Okay? Okay, so we can work out, for example, so you've probably seen the gravitational part before, but the part that's sort of new to us is the scalar field part, right? So we need to rewrite the scalar field part. So for example, we had a root g mu nu mu phi d nu phi, and we need to rewrite that in these coordinates, okay? So this is going to give us, what did we see, an n and a root h, is a 1/2. And then the spatial part, let's see, how much detail do I want to do? Yeah. The spatial part is easy, right? Because that's just going to bring down this guy from d0, 0. So let's just plug in a couple steps. So basically g0, 0 now, there's just a 1 over n squared. From that, d0 phi squared. And then it's the spatial part that gets a little more complicated, right? Because we're going to have this type of term appearing. So basically, I can look first at the pieces that have 1, 0 and 1i component, which I didn't write any of them here, but they're going to have the same form as this. There's always going to be an n minus 2. So then I want the piece that has d0 phi and I phi. And essentially that just has an ni and then a factor of 2 because there are basically two ways that I could have gotten it by symmetry. And then the piece that has the ij here, again there's an n squared plus. And then we have terms like n squared hij minus ni j. So this is the generic form of these guys. Okay. So you can rearrange all of this stuff, and basically a simpler way of writing it is root h n to the minus 1. 1/2, of course, is still there. And you can combine one of the d0 phi's, basically, with one of these components to get this cross term, and then you have the leftover part. Okay. So I realize that was a little bit fast, but it's probably worth it just to do a few of these steps yourself if you want. Okay. And the one that you might have seen before is to replace R4 by R3 plus a bunch of terms, right? And this bunch of terms is easy to write out in terms of the Riemann tensor. And then you want to just make some neat combination of those things. So it's easy to show that there are basically four other terms that combine pieces that live still in the time direction. So this is purely built from hij. Now, this is just the spatial part, okay? So this is just the spatial curvature of the 3 surface, so you can imagine that any curvature that's left over can essentially be written in terms of extrinsic curvature, which depends on the fact that this is embedded in the extra dimension of time, right? So there's a way, and maybe you guys have already seen this, that you can rewrite all of these terms in terms of that extrinsic curvature. And that's simplified, okay? So it's a lot of steps, but, so plus dot, dot, dot. And basically the only point is that all of this stuff has to be related to extrinsic curvature. And so let me put that result over here. So I'm going to get rid of this guy because we don't really need it. Um, But the full result, once we've done that, we do need. And so let me just write it as R4 is R3. This combination of things labeled E, and E is basically n times the extrinsic curvature, but the important thing for our purposes is what it is in terms of those hijs and lapse and shift, and that is just hij dot, and then there are derivatives of the ni and j's. Okay? And this again is the spatial part. So this is still this is a covariant derivative from living in the three directions. So for this guy, which is a vector, it actually matters that this is going to be di and j. And then connection piece and k. Okay. For this n, of course, it doesn't matter. It's just di. And this guy is basically n times k and j. Okay. Okay, so the other thing that we need now, so basically you can do this and now you can replace all the terms in the action. Okay. The other thing that we need to do to finish making things simple, though, is to choose a gauge, like we said. So we're going to make a choice of comoving gauge for the moment. And we already motivated with sort of what that's going to look like yesterday when we said it has a delta phi equals 0 in it. So that's part of it. Basically, we say delta phi equals 0, and then we make a particular choice for the form of hij. Hij, which should look familiar to you by now, because it has an a squared. And now, to avoid, I want to keep track of this coefficient. This is usually e to the ht squared, right? This is a squared. But I don't want to have explicit t's written, so I'm going to leave this as a generic function of time here and call it rho for the moment. And then there's sort of the usual thing. So before, we were writing 1 minus 2 psi here, right, in the generic sort of expansion. And remember, we found yesterday that in the comoving gauge, that variable zeta was a combination of psi and delta phi. And if I set delta phi equal to 0, psi was just minus zeta. So instead of 1 minus 2 psi here, I'm going to write 1 plus 2 zeta delta ij. And that takes care of my scalar mode. And then I'm going to have the leftover part, which before I was writing as hij, but now I've called this whole combination hij. So let's call this gamma. And gamma has the usual properties, right, that it's traceless, transverse, things like that. Okay. So basically, we have the scalar that's here. We have this n, which is a scalar but not a real scalar because it's going to be removed by the equation of motion. We have the tensor part, gamma ij. And then we have these ni's, which are the vector parts, essentially. And the ni's, again, are also going to be removed by equation of motion. Okay, so now one thing we can check, though, and I think I asked you this on the homework, not to work it out, but so notice that this guy, the spatial curvature, this is built from hij, and hij has this zeta in it. That is two derivatives. So it's going to just end up with two derivatives of zeta, essentially. So you can guess that this thing is going to go like d zeta squared. And if you work out what it really is, you get e to the minus 2, sorry, overall factor of 2, that rho minus zeta. And then there's two combinations of two derivative terms. And in case you want to check, those are the coefficients. Okay, so indeed, this does just go like two derivatives of zeta. And if you go to Fourier space, this essentially goes like k squared zeta, right, from two derivatives here. So often, zeta is called the spatial curvature, because it is in this sense. So when we talk about the perturbations relevant at the end of inflation, we often call them the curvature perturbations, and this is the origin, because that variable zeta that we saw, especially it's directly in this gauge, is actually just the spatial curvature. Well, here, let me put approximate because it's true here. Okay. Yeah. It should be plus. I think I had it plus on the homework, and then when you came, I thought, oh, maybe I made a mistake, but it's plus. Yeah. Right. Because in our original convention we had minus two psi, and we said zeta was minus psi. So the sign, okay, the sign doesn't matter for the 2-point function, but it matters for the 3-point function. So. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So basically, we have the whole action, and our next step. So fixing the gauge was one of the steps to removing, right, to finding the answer. The other step is replacing those n's and ni's by their solution to the equation of motion. So that's the part that's left to do. Still need equation of motion for n and I. So. Let me write the action in its full form in these variables at least once. This line here is going to be sort of the starting point of all the rest of the calculations. So if you want to check them, you'll need this line. So there's the spatial curvature term and the part that's coming, because we split off the time pieces, which is this extrinsic curvature piece. And then there's the stuff for the scalar field. And there's the kinetic term, which we at least roughly saw where that's coming from, d0 phi. And now, every time I write phi, I can put phi 0, right? Because in this gauge, there is no delta phi. So these phis are all going to be the background phis. And then a lot of things simplify, because in fact, in this gauge choice, right, anything that's a spatial derivative is going to vanish because that background phi is just a function of t. So we can drop all those terms. And there's another term that has two of these spatial derivatives, so we can drop that guy. This thing is squared. And then the only thing that's left over is the potential, which just gets a factor of n in front of it. Okay. Okay. So let me write. So you can see, for example, that the equation for n is actually pretty simple, right? So there are no time derivatives appearing. So the equation of motion is just going to be the variation of this guy with respect to n. And that's pretty simple, because just a lot of terms come out, right? This only contains n sub i's up to an overall. No, it only contains n sub i's. So there's n here, n here, n here, n here. So the equation for n is pretty simple. Let's write it over here. So that's one equation. Well, there are going to be two of them, right? Because we have two things to remove. So here's one. And the second one is also somewhat easy because basically n sub i's appear with derivatives everywhere, right? So there's covariant derivatives for n sub i's inside of this guy. And then there's only this one that you have to worry about, essentially besides that. Okay. So that one is much shorter. And it just looks like this. Oops, sorry. Okay. So now we have to solve these order by order. In the perturbations, right? So we want to expand everybody that we have. So phi we already expanded, phi plus delta phi. We set delta phi equals 0. These guys, the n's and the n's phi's, we still need to expand to some order. And then we can plug back in, and we want to generate the action to second order in perturbations. Okay. So we need to start expanding. And n, the choice of starting with 1 here, right, is basically choosing what we set as our as time versus physical time. So n is, we can set to 1, that's a fine choice. And then we have the first term, so let's write it as delta n. But we can imagine that this is really a sum of terms, and at each order in delta n, they're going to take the nth order of perturbations, right? So let me write that as n sub 1, n sub 2. And the idea here that is that if zeta is essentially our, you know, a single order in perturbation, this goes like zeta squared, etc. So that's going to allow us to keep to consistent order in zeta. And then n sub I, or n I, so just like we've done for any vector, we can write this as a scalar part and a transverse part. So we can write it as, and here a psi is creeping back in. Okay, and we're going to find that basically this guy we can treat as 0, right, because that's only related to the vector part. Here we're only interested in the scalar part, and it's going to be consistent, in fact, to find that all these guys go to 0. So we just need to worry about this. This is going to be from the equation. Okay, so when we do that, so this is a big long step that I'm skipping, but there's not much physics in there, it's just solving. You plug this guy into there, you get you get an equation of motion at each order for these guys, and you solve those. So the solution is that the first order term here goes like zeta dot over h. So h I'm calling rho dot. So here we put rho. But let me substitute in rho dot equals h, keeping in mind that this is in general something like ht. Okay? So this is just going to put things in a more familiar looking form. As I said before, this guy is 0. And then you get a slightly messier equation for this part of the n sub I, which is minus e to the minus 2 rho. So a to the minus 2, essentially, zeta over h plus a piece. So for the most part, this part of the solution isn't going to matter. I'm going to write it so that you have the whole thing, but it's not going to matter for what we do. This guy is equal to pi dot squared. And I'm going to put the implinks back in so that you have the dimension correctly. OK. So the basic thing that's going to matter to us actually is this one and this piece. OK. And plug it back in, and you can get S2. That's the basic idea. Now, at this point, I know I haven't showed you where all the steps are coming from, but there's something that's a little bit funny, right? Because I want second order in fluctuations. And there I expanded those guys to first order. Am I sure I don't need to expand those guys to second order? And there's a neat trick that you can use to show that actually, even though it's not obvious at this point, to get S of order zeta to the n, so I was calling that Sn, so third order in fluctuation would be n equals 3, we only need all of these guys, so n here, n or n sub I, we only need those, how was I labeling it? We only need those guys to the n minus 2. So actually what we've done here is nice, because we can also get the third order term in the action without having to solve the next order equation for these guys. Okay, and this, I think, is an unusual calculation, so I wanted to sketch a little bit for you how this part of it goes. So the stuff that I am skipping is sort of standard. I think you probably know how to do that in principle. But this is an interesting point, so I want to say a little bit more about this, because I'm not sure exactly where else it happens, but it's really useful here. Okay. So why? How do we show this? So basically what's going to happen is that the terms proportional to n to the n minus 1 or n to the n are all going to multiply equations of motion for lower order stuff. So basically what will happen is, so terms like zeta to the n to the n, and zeta to the n, let's see, I guess I better make this n minus 1 and n minus 2. I want this whole thing to be of order zeta to the n. So I want this thing to add up to n and this thing to add up to n. Which doesn't work, does it? Let's try this. Okay. So this whole term in the action, so this is a part of Sn. Terms like this, it's going to turn out that what multiplies this, so it actually multiplied by equation of motion of the lower order stuff. And so they cancel out. So to see that, it's kind of nice. You can basically just expand. So we want an expression for the generic equation of motion at the given order. And we're going to need to tailor expand the expression for the equation of motion. And you also need to tailor expand the action. And then you're basically going to use the appropriate piece of the tailor expansion of the equation of motion in the appropriate term of the action and see that they're the same. So you would need Taylor expand first the equation delta S equals 0. And I'm going to write everything for this, the n with no index, just the scalar part, because it's simpler. But the same thing goes through for n sub I. It just has more complicated notation. So basically, you know what this is, because you can vary the stuff that comes inside, and you have to take the variation with respect to derivatives. And the variation with respect to the field. But there are only spatial derivatives here, no time derivatives here, right? Because that was the thing that it was non-dynamical. And you want this equal to 0. So if you tailor expand each of these guys, that's one step that you need. And the second step that you need is to tailor expand the action itself. Right, because you need to know what the coefficient of terms proportional to zeta to the n is. So, for example, if I want to work on the top term there, what I want to write is so usually, right, what we do is we, and what's going to be important is that we do integration by parts to move this derivative, and that's going to matter later. But for now, we can just write it in this more simple form like this. So, basically, what we mean by Taylor expanding is that we want this thing first to be evaluated where all of the delta n is equal to 0. Okay, so with no fluctuation. So the first term is just going to be this guy and delta n equals 0. So that means I'm discarding all of these pieces here. And then again, there are two variables. So we're going to have, at next order, two terms. And those two terms are going to look like, if we vary again with respect to dj, so really I would have delta partial jn, but I'm just swapping where the delta sits. And now this had one derivative, so this term's going to have two derivatives, the original one and this one. And again, I want to evaluate it here. And then it has a term when I take the derivative with respect to the other guy, right? So that's just delta n. And it's going to be a dn, dn, and so on. Right? The next term is going to be 1/2, bunch of terms. And so this term is going to have 3, right? It's going to have 2 derivatives with respect to this, 2 derivatives with respect to this, and then a mixed term of each type of derivative. Okay? And to make this worthwhile, what we need to do is organize it in powers of delta, or in powers of zeta, sorry, so in powers of the fluctuation. So reorganize. In powers of zeta. So if I look at the term, and I just want to do this one because we're going to see that you can verify for yourself that it's the right equation. This procedure makes sense. So if I look at terms that are of order zeta to the 0, right, so this should essentially be the lowest order equation of motion. But let's just see if we get it right. That's going to be coming from, so let's see. So the first term I had over there was this guy multiplied by a delta n. So if I want any hope, so basically usually what happens when we do this is we do an integration by parts, so this becomes a delta n. We pull out the delta n, and what sits inside there then is the equation of motion, right? So the power of zeta that lives inside that delta n isn't really going to matter. What matters is the power that's coming in this Taylor expansion. Does that make sense? So I only need to worry about that, and that means basically that the only term that I want are these pieces evaluated at delta n equals 0 and zeta to the 0. And then I don't care about that piece because I'm going to pull it out anyway. And then the next one, again, delta n equals 0, zeta 0. So then we do the usual thing, integrate by parts. Pull out delta n, and you should recover the lowest order equation of motion. Let me call that background. And you can check that's exactly what happens. And if we hadn't, so basically, we already made the choice n equals 1 here, right? But that's the only piece that would have appeared in this lowest order thing, because this delta n was equal to 0. And so in fact, if you were to keep that in general, you would get the same equation of motion that Andrew derived a couple weeks ago, where again, we had kept that n general for the scalar field, okay? So if you want, you can keep that general just to see what happens. You'll see it shows up in the same place that it showed up when he did it. But in fact, you get exactly that background equation of motion. And the only thing that's different here is that you can check, basically, that those EIJs, right, those only were functions of zeta. So the only thing that was making this action fancy compared to the scalar field before was that it had these extrinsic curvature terms. But those guys only have perturbations appearing. So when you evaluate this at zero order of perturbation, it all drops out, and it's just back to the same thing. Okay, so I guess probably it's too long for me to go through this whole thing. It's a long calculation, but it's kind of nice. So I would encourage you to actually check this because it's kind of neat if you're interested. And it's extremely important for the amount of work you have to do to calculate these things for inflation. But basically the only other thing that we need, and I'll just sort of sketch how it goes, is delta S. For example, at order 1 power of the fluctuation. So our goal, remember I said that the reason that those terms to the n and the n minus 1 were removed is because they were multiplied by the lower order equation of motion. And the only ones we need to check this are essentially the first two, the equation of motion at this level and the equation of motion at the next level. And then you can see that those are the things that pop up. So we also need this. And this guy has several terms, but let me just mention that there's one simplification. So you can see already that, of course, there are going to be terms still coming from here. But now, so here we restricted to zeta to the 0. There are going to be these same terms with zeta to the 1. any other guy. But then there are also going to be terms coming from the second order of this expansion. So basically here, I automatically have one power of the fluctuation here, so I can look at this guy restricted to zeta to the zero. So because they both have this coefficient, let me write them together. So this already had d, j, n, delta n, just from here. And there's another term which is going to have, so let me factor it out. It's simpler. Dj delta n. And this already is one power of fluctuation, so then I want the thing that it multiplies to be at zeta to the zero order. And both of these guys multiply that. And then there are two more terms, which you might guess, coming from this guy, but now with zeta to the 1, and coming from this guy, where this term again is evaluated at zeta 0. Does that make sense? You know, it's a lot of algebra. But two more, similarly, like this and this. And the thing that's nice here is that cross terms, it's a little bit non-trivial to show, cross terms are higher order. And so you don't have to keep any cross terms. And basically, you can show that by, if you like, you can just check that when you take those two mixed derivatives, the term that would have been in first order actually cancels out. So this is the trick that you need. Okay, and then you get an expression for the equation of motion at this order. So basically what I'm saying here is that if I take a mixed derivative it's of order zeta and higher. So here when I needed to restrict these guys to zeta zero. So if I had included a mixed term, I couldn't have done that, essentially. That piece would have been zero. Okay, so that's just a trick you need. Anyway, so that simplifies. And then you can go back, and you can do this step. So we need delta s theta 0, delta s theta 1, in here. And then you can see the result. That's a lot of algebra, so I won't do it. But it's nice. So basically what that means is that all the work that we've done, the solution that's on the board over there, is all you need to do to calculate the two-point function and to calculate the three-point function. Have it all. So we said that the procedure was just to plug into the action, this solution, and find the terms that are second order in fluctuations. And you also need to do some integration by parts if you want to get it in this form. And you find, ready everybody, it's the big moment. So let me restore the M planks just so that you have them. I guess this should be, yeah, G. So when I'm writing this minus G here, what I actually mean is A cubed. Because I want this to look like the action for the scalar field and the de Sitter background. So you find that what you actually get are the right powers of A, or this e to the 2 rho, more precisely, if you want to be precise. But I'm going to write that as A cubed, which I can write as rho g, okay? Just to make it look more familiar. There's a factor here, and you get exactly what you would expect, basically, for a free scalar field. D nu. Okay? Exactly just the kinetic term. So it looks like a massless free scalar. And what's interesting is that the prefactor has an epsilon. So to get the epsilon here, I'm always using the fact that phi dot squared for the background is 2m Planck squared h squared epsilon. Okay. So phi dot squareds are what's going to appear because they appear in the solution here, basically. I guess that's the only place. But you can always replace them with epsilons. Okay. So what does this mean? So this equation is important. So there are several things to notice. So the first thing is we have a free massless scalar, almost. And the almost, part of the almost is just that zeta is dimensionless, so we need to make it, give it the right dimension. But the second part of the almost is that epsilon goes to 0 implies this thing goes to 0. So this is the second important manifestation of the fact that we can't have exact Sitter space. If we were in exact Sitter space, then the fluctuation essentially would have been a gauge mode. The fact that we're not in exact Sitter space, that we have this evolving scalar field, allows us to have in some sense a real curvature perturbation outside the horizon. Otherwise, we could have always removed it by changing how we sliced our slices or measured time. Okay, so what that means is epsilon equals 0. This is a gauge mode. And the way that that's been popping up in stuff that we've done before is that often we've been dividing by phi dot, essentially phi 0 dot everywhere. Right, which is related to epsilon. And if phi 0 dot is 0, then all of those things that we've been doing have been ill-defined. So it's always relied on the fact when we've been making these transformations in time and things like that, that this was non-zero. Okay, and that's essentially the statement that epsilon is non-zero. So the field is evolving, H is evolving. So this is another version of H dot not equal to 0. Okay. So if this isn't the right mechanism for inflation, that doesn't mean you can't get fluctuations some other way, but it just means if this is the mechanism, the way that we get fluctuations by this fluctuations of the scalar field can only work if epsilon is not equal to 0. Okay, so all we have to do, essentially, is rescale the field to get the solution now. So we can basically, so if epsilon is more or less constant, so if this isn't true, you're going to get slow roll corrections, but that's okay, you can calculate those. But just for simplicity, let's suppose it's nearly constant, then we can define a new field, zeta hat k, and absorb in there this factor of 2 epsilon, so it's going to be a root 2 epsilon, and there's an m Planck. And we already know that if we did that and all we had left here was a free massless scalar field, we already know that the spectrum for that, the zeta k hat prime, was 2 pi cubed delta function in k times h squared over 2 k cubed. This is in the long wavelength limit. Okay, and we know how to transform that into a power spectrum, and we know how to change it to zeta, so changing variables. We go from, this was a p, k of zeta hat, pk of zeta hat goes to pk of zeta, which is just h squared over 2k cubed. And the conversion factor is just a 1 over 2 epsilon m Planck squared. Okay. So this tells us that the dimensionless power spectrum, this thing we were calling p zeta of k, is just h squared over 8 pi squared m Planck squared epsilon. And the important thing, basically, is that these quantities here, this is in K-space, these quantities need to be evaluated at horizon crossing. Okay, because here, essentially, we were working in the limit that as we crossed the horizon, that's, this was true. Okay? And really, there might be plus slow roll corrections. Okay, so that's it. That's the power spectrum for the scalar field. So what we'll do this afternoon is basically discuss a little bit about a couple features of this solution, because I didn't actually write for you, although you know it, the equation of motion for zeta. We'll talk a little bit about the other gauge choice we could have made, which is related to what you've been doing in the homework and the tutorial about changing gauge by thinking about this time transformation. And we'll do the graviton part, the gravitational part. Okay.